Today's message is on solitude and silence. The reason why I'm speaking on this particular topic is because we want to continue a trajectory of learning to pray. Many Christians come to me and say, I'd like to have a better devotional time, or I want to be closer to God. The reality is this: the foundation of the spiritual life is solitude and silence. And the spiritual life, and let me define that word for you. The word spiritual in the Christian context always, always has meant historically to be filled with the Holy Spirit. There has been never any other biblical understanding. Of course, our world has co-opted that terminology, and everything is spiritual. We have people who say, I am spiritual. What they actually mean is that they have some kind of personal internal well-being. And that is not Christian spirituality. Christian spirituality is specific. And what then does it mean to be filled with the Holy Spirit? In some cases, we're scared off by our brothers and sisters who are of the charismatic traditions, like Pentecostals or Assemblies of God and many other expressions. And we see them maybe jumping up and down or shouting or doing manifestations that frighten those who are from more contemplative traditions. But understand that that is not the quintessential expression of Christian spirituality. Neither quietness nor noisiness in worship is an expression of true Christian spirituality. It does not indicate the presence. What does the indwelling of the Holy Spirit actually mean? It means that you become aware of the reality of God all around you and even within you. And you begin to interact with God through that reality and that perception. Solitude and silence, therefore, are the beginning of creating that awareness, that space for God. Now, you and I have become aware of God in some way, shape, or form, and the desire to be with Him, the general word that we use, which is to pray, comes not actually from us. Our desire to pray comes from really the initiative of God. Sometimes He comes to us through a whisper, an internal prompting. He may come to us through something loud, a crisis event in our lives. But God comes to each of us in very different ways, so never judge another person by the way in which they have seen and encountered God. But encourage them to continue, and encourage yourself to continue, to then respond and seek God. The practice and pursuit of solitude and silence, the very foundation of the Christian life, if we are to be Christian, the very foundations of the spiritual life from a Christian dimension. All these things are a response to God and not an initiative. You cannot make yourself more spiritual. Other religions do this. If you think about Buddhism or Hinduism, their prayers make them more, quote unquote, using the term, spiritual. In the Christian life, it is not from our own effort, but from our posture of attentiveness. The active party in the relationship with God is God. Now, this does not mean that we're completely passive and just lie there at home and let God talk at us. But in the indwelling of the Spirit, in the presence of God, we are then called to live. And the way that we live is a response to God. But how will you know how to live or what to do with your life if you don't hear Him? If you don't have solitude and silence? Now, the reason why I put solitude and silence together is because the two are actually inseparable. Richard Foster writes this: without silence, there is no solitude. Though silence sometimes involves the absence of speech, it always involves the act of listening. Simply to refrain from talking, without a heart listening to God, is not silence. Dallas Willard, a friend of Richard Foster, and they work together a lot, writes this: silence and solitude go hand in hand usually. Just as silence is vital to make solitude real, so is solitude needed to make the discipline of silence complete. Very few of us can be silent in the presence of others. So let's begin to examine some of these things. And let's begin with solitude. Let's separate these two inseparable things, but examine them and consider what they mean. John Ortberg, who also writes about spirituality as an evangelical Christian, says this about solitude: solitude is the one place where we gain freedom from the forces of our society that will otherwise relentlessly mold and shape us. We are drawn to hurry. It makes us feel important. It keeps the adrenaline pumping. It means we don't have to look too closely at the heart of life. It keeps us from feeling our loneliness. Solitude is a remedy for the busyness that charms us. I would go as far as some people here have heard me say and quote the Desert Fathers. And they have this very interesting phrase. One of them had said, busyness is moral laziness. As an Asian, as someone who comes from an immigrant household, as someone who lives in North America, my culture shapes me to say the hard work reaps benefits. The harder you work, the better you will do. Right? And so when I approach something like solitude, it can be difficult. Even in Christian ministry, pastors wear a badge like everyone else in our society. The busier you are, the better you are, the more valuable you are. This is true in many different cases. Many people are pressed in their place of work to just get more done. And the more you get done, sometimes the more you are rewarded. If not monetarily, the more you are rewarded by your influence and by your reputation as being someone who does much and does more. And early in the life of our church community, coming from a larger, a medium-sized church, one of the struggles I faced was that now we had a very small community of about 20 adults. And where do we go with that? And people would keep on asking, when are we going to build a building? When are we going to expand? How are we going to grow this bigger and bigger? And those are the pressures I reflected on. Because success, even in religious business, has to do with size. Gross national product. Gross ecclesiastical product. That is how you measure nations. And that is how you measure churches. So for me, it was an ongoing struggle to stay not busy because of what the Desert Fathers taught me. That busyness is moral laziness. But I always will have this tension. It's just built into my culture, into my well-being kind of thing, that I have to stay busy. I have to be doing something. And you can ask Pastor Diana, because I always, you know, I share with her, I feel kind of weird. I struggle against this. This sense of what does it mean to be not busy and yet feel valued. But there were benefits to not loading my schedule to the gills. When you call me sometimes, not all the time, I will be able to talk to you. Usually it takes about a week if you want an appointment where I've got already stacked up. But I try to keep it as open as possible. I need to have space where I can pray. I need space where I can read. I need space where I can ride my bike, which is God. I need space to walk with people and talk with them. I'm not a psychiatrist or a therapist in which someone comes into my office and I've got my eye on the clock. You've got 30 minutes to tell me exactly how to fix you. Instead, most of my time is spent walking with people, talking with them. And in fact, if you've been in this church long enough, this is what I've done with you at some point. And this grows from solitude. If we're too busy engaging with the world's values molds us. Our church is not measured by its size. We have grown, as you've seen. But it's measured by the size of the souls in the people that are here. Your capacity to hear God. Your ability to love others. That's it. It's not that God doesn't value large churches. I'm sure they listen to God. I'm sure they have a spirituality of their own. And I don't fault them for it. This is not a case of sour grapes. I have many friends who are larger church pastors. I understand their struggle. And there are larger church pastors who lose themselves. And I get to talk to them. And I thank God for our little quiet community in this season. But it's not the size of the church. It's the fact that you know each other and are learning to love each other. If that does not happen within a Christian person, then I don't know what we're doing as Christians. In solitude, we confront our own soul with its obscure forces and conflicts that escape our attention when we are interacting with others. We can only survive solitude if we cling to Christ there. What do you think about when you're alone? Are you ever alone? For some of you who have young children, I've been there, and sometimes I'm still there. It's really hard to be alone. It's hard to find space to even think sometimes. Some of us are engaged in work. It's so demanding that we're exhausted by the end of the day and we just run a cycle to survive from day to day. But let me say this. You can find solitude in the midst of many people. Foster continues to write this. Jesus calls us from loneliness to solitude. The fear of being left alone petrifies people. Loneliness is inner emptiness. But solitude is inner fulfillment. Solitude is more a state of mind and heart than a physical place. There is a solitude of the heart that can be maintained at all times. Now, given that to be able to maintain solitude at all times is a very practiced spiritual thing. I remember stories of Susanna Wesley who had over 10 children, like 15 children running around the house. And the story was that she would put her apron over her head. I mean, it's like a one-room house. Okay, it's like one of those houses, like an old school, or maybe two. And she put her apron over her head, and at that moment, the children know not to talk to her. It was her sign. Now, not the most spiritual sign, not the most elegant, but it was her sign that she needed solitude. Even with like 10 screaming kids, you know, and maybe some older ones trying to corral the other ones. Just putting of the apron over the head was her sign that I live with God. And she needed it. And it was a sign to the children who then learned to read that tradition in their home that mommy is with God at the moment. And that God can be everywhere. Solitude is not isolation, but contains within it a deeper appreciation for a community that values it. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, one of my favorite authors, writes that the one who is afraid of being alone should beware of being with others. Likewise, if we fear being with others, we should beware of being alone. In other words, introversion or extroversion can be excuses for spiritual, psychological, and emotional sicknesses. And not only excuses, they may be merely indicators that there's something wrong. If you don't like people, any people, certain people are more likable than others. But if you don't like people in general, something's wrong. And you need to look into it. If you don't like yourself, there's something wrong. And you need to look into it. So whether you like just being with people, because what happens is you can avoid yourself that way. Or if you like just being by yourself and avoid others, because then you can avoid other people and what they might say. There might be insecurities there. Those are indicators. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer speaks about that. And how community, a healthy community, allows us to heal. And so solitude can be practiced and should be practiced in a form of community. So that is solitude. Now, the relationship we then switch to is silence. And I have not been silent for the past 10 minutes, so I'll say this. Silence is born of solitude. True silence. And should not be born out of loneliness or isolation. I'd like to give you an illustration of this. They're playing you a trailer of a movie called Into Great Silence. And you'll have an idea of what this is all about. Silence. The only sounds you will hear is their chanting through their prayers on a daily basis. They are also allowed one day where they are talking. It's very interesting. If you're interested, the whole film is actually on YouTube. But I warn you, it's 2.5 hours of silence, except for the sounds of their shuffling feet, except for the sounds of their movements, their chanting. And there's one very interesting dimension where they were visited, because one of the monks we'll see later was interviewed on the day that he could talk. And it's funny what they talk about. They go and go, well, tobogganing without toboggans. And all they do is they chit-chat. Like you or I at lunch. Talking about the monastery down, you know, down in the Nix Valley. How their bathrooms are better than ours. Laughing. These are the sounds of their talking that one day of the year. But they're an example of silence that probably you and I will never live out. We may romanticize it, but realize there's relationships in the monastery itself that are difficult. Their relationships here that may be difficult. A disciplined person is a person who can do what needs to be done when it needs to be done. If we are silent when we should speak, we are not living in the discipline of silence. If we speak when we should be silent, we again miss the mark. This is from Richard Foster's Reflections. I went on a retreat once, and I was a lone retreatant by myself. I think I did this in one of my sabbaticals. And I just went there by myself, and I met a chef or a cook in the kitchen of this retreat place, who was preparing a meal for a large group. And as I talked to this cook, I learned that she wasn't actually a Christian, that she was just called in and hired to cook. And so I was, you know, cooking my thing, and she was cooking her thing, and we're just chatting. And suddenly, through the door, came a very dour-faced woman. Like, whoa. I said, please be quiet. We're having a silent retreat. I learned something from that. Silence in itself is not necessarily to be elevated above others. And in that case, I felt sad and offended. And I can only imagine what this non-Christian cook felt. Here she was having a pleasant conversation, and they were shushed into silence. So do not allow any of these things to be a shackle to you, solitude or silence. They are meant to free you. They are meant to free you. Free your mind, your heart, and your spirit. So that you speak in appropriate times and in appropriate ways. And that you're silent when you need to be. The passage we read of Jesus himself is very important. Early in the morning, in his particular case, very early, he goes up to the mountainside in solitude, silence, to pray. But he's not offended when the disciples themselves wake up and find that he's gone. And go running around, all harried, looking for Jesus. And I like how in many translations there's an exclamation mark when they say, "Don't you know everyone is looking for you?" Perhaps it reminds me of when Mary and Joseph lost him when he was 12 in Jerusalem. They're all harried and they come, "What are you doing? We've been worried sick." And he says, "Don't you know I need to be in my Father's house?" How many of us live that way with God? We are to live with God that way. He took those things and interruptions in stride. Oh, you cut me out. Oh, hey. And let me read this also from Foster. "Silence goes beyond solitude. And without it, solitude has little effect. Silence is frightening because it strips us as nothing else does, throwing us upon the stark realities of our life." So that was Dallas Willard. This is Foster. "One reason we can hardly bear to remain silent is that it makes us feel so helpless. We are so accustomed to relying upon words to manage and control others. If we are silent, who will take control? God will take control. But we will never let Him take control until we trust Him. Silence is intimately related to trust. Silence is one of the deepest disciplines, simply because it puts the stopper on all self-justification." So what can we do in our busy lives? It's not like we can go fly over to France, the Grand Chartreuse, and join the monastery. We have friends, we have obligations, we have responsibilities in our here and in our now. And you are called to the here and now of your lives. You are called to the here and now. You're in Vancouver, in your relationships for a reason. Whether the reasons are called of God or situations you need to redeem because you found yourself into them by your own making. What can you do? Well, here's some practical tips and hints. The first of four suggestions is this. What I call little solitudes. I've already alluded to it with Susanna Wesley, pulling the apron over her head. Now, you may not have an apron, don't worry about it. But it's taking snatches of time throughout the day to reflect. This may have been sold to you as devotional time or quiet time. And sometimes in some of our histories, we have been given it as an obligation. You need to have quiet time, or you're not a good Christian. Well, let me put it this way. If you love God, if He's calling to you, pick up the phone. Say hello. Just say, "I'm listening." More details of this is, go take a walk. Go to the toilet. Allow yourself to be alone, even on the bus. Take the music headphones out and listen to God as He speaks even around you, whether it be through nature or through circumstance. Second, secondly, another suggestion, is to develop a quiet place. Establishing a place that helps you find silence and solitude. There's a famous movie about a guy who went and built himself a log cabin in Alaska. There's two you can find on the internet. He's by himself the whole time. It's a lot like Into Great Silence. The only thing is he commentates the whole thing. But physically, he's not talking to anyone. Because there's no one there. As he builds this cabin, log by log, and hews it out of the trees. It's an incredible piece of filmmaking, because he's got the little camera, you know, he puts it there and he builds this thing and he lives up there. Now, you might not do this for your quiet place. For some people, like I said, the water closet, the washroom, is a very private place. And for some people, that's all they've got. It's better than an apron, I suppose. But it's something that you a place you may go to. I know people who have built small places of prayer. In some traditions, they call it a prayer desk. A place where they sit. There's nothing on the desk, really. And they pray. Or they spend it in silence. Or they may journal. It is the place that they have given for themselves. A place that they have given to God. We don't have a cathedral to go to where you can sit and absorb all the grandeur of the rock and the arches and everything else. But in Vancouver, we certainly have the mountains. And in this season, we have the blossoms. And one day, this tree will blossom too. Develop a place that you can go, even on the outside. It could be a trail that you walk. It could be a table. It could be a desk. Any corner. Not everyone has these. That's a suggestion that might be helpful to you. A third suggestion is taking the opportunity to exercise what we call few words. To determine to use an economy of words, no small talk, to always speak from the heart. You may want to do this for a short amount of time, and may determine an afternoon or a morning or a day for a few words, where you don't jibber jabber, so to speak. In the Proverbs, one of the Proverbs in the Bible tells us simply, actually multiple ones, that even a fool is considered wise when they keep silent. And when you speak, you reveal your foolishness. Exercise few words. It might be something worth engaging. And finally this, as a suggestion, perhaps spend a day in silence. It would be hard to do that without solitude. Perhaps even longer span of time. Perhaps just start with a morning where you say, I will be in silence. In certain silent retreats, I know retreatants are given a button. Not a button you press, but a button they put on their, you know, shirt that says, in silence. So people know not to go, hey, how's it going? You know, and how you doing? High five. And then, oh, yeah. But even so, if you are in silence and someone greets you, I've always taught this to my retreatants if we're on silent retreat, greet them in return. And then move on. Your silence is exercise of grace. So those are four suggestions you might want to explore, short of joining the Grand Chartreuse. But here's what I want you to take away from this. In solitude, we realize that we are never alone. Only in solitude do you realize that you are never alone. Sounds like a contradiction, but it isn't. Because God is always present. And secondly, in silence, we not only listen to the voice of God, but to His heart. In silence, we hear the heart of God. I want to show you an example, again from the movie, of a blind monk who has learned in the silence what it is to hear the heart of God.
C'est le verset de tous les jours. Et pas des mots. Mais on sera peut-être bien, j'espère, plus on est heureux. Et par exemple, c'est la fin de la fin de notre vie, ça. Plus on se rapproche de Dieu, plus on est heureux, plus on va vivre. On sera peut-être. On ne doit pas avoir peur de la mort, au contraire. C'est une grande joie pour nous de retrouver un père. Le passé et le présent, c'est humain, ça. Quand on prend Dieu, il n'y a pas de passé. Il est dans le présent. Et donc, quand il nous voit, il voit toute notre vie déjà. Et c'est pour ça qu'il, comme il est un être infiniment bon, il cherche toujours notre bien. Et dans tout ce qui nous arrive, eh bien, rien pas s'inquiéter. Et je remercie très souvent Dieu de m'avoir rendu aveugle. Et je suis certain que ça dépend bien de mon âme qu'il a permis ça. Le mot, c'est que le monde a perdu le sens de Dieu, n'est-ce pas? C'est dommage, hein, parce que
ils n'ont pas raison. Ils n'ont plus de raison de vivre, n'est-ce pas? Si on supprime la pensée de Dieu, elle ne peut pas vivre.
Mais on doit toujours partir du principe que
Dieu est infiniment bon, et tout ce qu'il fait, c'est pour notre bien. C'est pour ça qu'on doit toujours être heureux. Un chrétien ne devrait jamais être triste. Parce que tout ce qui lui arrive, est voulu par Dieu, ou au moins permis par Dieu, et pour le bien de son âme. Et bien alors, c'est l'essentiel pour nous, n'est-ce pas ça? Dieu qui est infiniment bon, tout puissant, et qui nous aide. Et qu'à faire ça, on est heureux.
Moment.